Britain and Russia, eternal enemies or brothers under the skin? Hello, I'm Mark Galliotti, and welcome to my view of Russia in Moscow shadows. This podcast of varying length, frequency and format, yet always reassuringly low production values, is supported by generous and perspicacious patrons like you, and also by the crisis exercise software company Conductor. I've been reading an advanced copy of a very interesting new book, which is in some ways what really triggered the topic for this particular podcast. The book is The First Cold War, Anglo-Russian Relations in the 19th Century by Barbara Emerson, which has just been published by Hearst. And really, it's obvious, well, as you can tell from the title, it's about Anglo-Russian relations in the 19th century. But in particular, the way that in some ways arm's length, but nonetheless very significant alliance against Napoleon at the beginning of the century essentially degenerated into an increasingly acrimonious relationship, and in particular one that is going to be shaped by the so-called The Great Game. The fear on Britain's part, not at all founded one, that Russia aimed at India. Not necessarily for India's sake, but also to distract Britain so that it could maintain its constant pressure against Constantinople. And this all ends up sort of culminating in the Crimean War in the 1850s, where you have British and French troops, as well as others like Piedmontese, fighting the Russians. And it's worth noting, after all, the Crimean War, yes, it was fought on the Crimean Peninsula, but in many ways it was won not on the peninsula itself, but actually in the Baltic, where you have largely British naval operations to try and strangle Russian trade. And again, that's really important because it demonstrates to Russia once again that the naval dimension of power in an essentially mercantile age is actually very significant, and obviously that's where Britain has its strength. And as a result, these tensions build up until the point when they both come to realise towards the end of the century and the beginning of the 20th century that, frankly, they have more to fear from Wilhelmine Germany than from each other, not least because in some ways these are two countries operating in different spheres. It's an excellent book, it's very readable, and it scores highly on those two great subjective scales. Firstly, do I agree with what's said? And secondly, do I wish I'd written it? Lots of lovely details and nice anecdotes. And let me just sort of pick up on just a couple, which again I found interesting because they had particularly strong resonance. Even though I have to say, the book ends with a rather kind of odd abruptness, which I didn't quite understand. Anyway, at an early point, talking about, and I'll be coming onto this in a moment, the very early 16th century, real start of there just simply being relations between Muscovy and England at the time. There was a particular an embassy from Ivan the Terrible to England, headed by Osip Neper, who distinctly failed to impress on his arrival, even though he was feted and such like. And the reason was, in some ways, was because, as the Muscovy Company merchants complained, he thinks that every man will beguile him. As the Russians do not always speak the truth themselves, they think that other people are like them. I mean, I think that's quite interesting because, this is very much the problem that we have today, is that, and we have had at other times as well, is precisely that you have an essentially pretty duplicitous political culture, which regards truth as something that is, an optional extra. Above all, narratives are to be mobilised. And to a degree, for that very reason, people like Putin, certainly people like Patrushev, people who are constantly deploying conspiracy theories and the like, will always automatically assume that when we tell them things, it's not a question of that we're actually trying to tell them something specific, but rather, what are we actually trying to say? There's always got to be a truth behind the truth, because they themselves operate that way. So it's quite interesting to find these real resonances. Later on, though, I also there was a fascinating sort of insight into what we could think of as the very early forerunners of the 20th century, 21st century London grad phenomenon, whereby rich Russians come to London for the lifestyle, for the security and so forth. What she talks about is in the late 18th century, there was this influx of Russians coming into Britain to do things like study agricultural methods, which were being revolutionised at the time. And as they came, so too, on a kind of grand tour, did we also get princes, princesses, aristocrats, and all kinds of rich people, including Princess Catherine Dashkova, who travels the length and breadth of the British Isles, spending money like water, is received by King George III and Queen Charlotte, and is generally making very strong inroads into what we could think of as English high society at the time, but then has to leave after it turns out that, in fact, it's her half-brother who is one of the key figures behind the chapel of the Sardinian ambassador being sacked in the Gordon riots of 1780. So, a bit of scandal, the dissolute members of the family embarrassing the much more genteel ones. Again, something seemed terribly familiar. But, of course, on the whole, political relations are still very much at that particular time shaped by interdynastic and intermonarchical relations. There's an interesting little sort of note here about how Queen Victoria ended up sizing up Tsar Nicholas I, who, after all, on the one hand, you know, he was reputed to be, in his youth, the most handsome young man in all of Europe. But on the other hand, many people did sort of note his distinct inflexibility. And what she says is, he is stern and severe, with fixed principles of duty which nothing on earth will make him change. Very clever I do not think him, and his mind is an uncivilized one. His education has been neglected. Politics and military concerns are the only things he takes great interest in. The arts and all softer occupations he is insensible to, but he is sincere, I am certain, sincere even in his most despotic acts, from a sense that it is the only way to govern. To be honest, I think actually that's a really rather astute assessment of Nicholas I. But the last point I would actually sort of bring up from the book, that just again, this is very much just a sort of a little random selection of things that noted. There's an interesting perspective about what's happening way off in the Far East at the end of the 19th century, in which actually the book outlines the way that you have policy being shaped by a whole variety of different agencies, whether it's, you know, a timber concession that's operating on the basis of grants by China and Korea that then becomes a vehicle of Russian expansion, whether it's other individual figures who are either trying to convince Nicholas II of their own particular pet policies or just simply carrying them out as is. And again, this was a fascinating example of the way that the adhocracy that is so central to Putin's regime, in other words, this sense that you have multiple competing and overlapping interests and factions and individuals, and essentially sometimes you're playing them off against each other in the classic principles of divide and rule. At other times, you're just letting them off going doing their things, because you can always actually roll something back and point to the fact that there was no official sanction given if it turns out badly, and if it turns out well, you can adopt it as state policy. But the point is that there is this constant sub-state level variety of non-state actors and semi-state actors who are in some ways doing state activities. This is something that clearly was a very powerful element within late Tsarism, just as it is a powerful element within late Putinism. But anyway, the main point is, as I said, having read this book, it reminded me of generally something that I've been thinking about for quite some time, which is the interesting and complex relationship between Russia and Britain, and the way that they are in some ways eternal frenemies, with both common interests that frankly have lasted through centuries and are likely to continue to last, but also a whole variety of reasons why they're also at loggerheads. So that's what I thought I would talk about more broadly. And look, my basic point is this. You know, you in Russia, you have a country that is beset both by Anglophobia and Anglophilia. I mean, for example, it has to be said that Emerson's book very much focuses much more on the Anglophobia side of things, which is, you know, pretty much inevitable given the chronological focus on the 19th century and what's going on. But in fact, you know, there is a very, very strong parallel sense of Anglophilia. In some ways, that is seemingly out of scale with the actual degree of contact, it would seem, between Russia and Britain. And certainly even the Anglophobia is not just simply a hangover from the 19th century Great Game. Instead, there is this sense of Britain as a land of justice and fair play, which really matters if you come from a country with neither. And again, actually, here's one other quote from the book. This is from Prince Alexander Kurakin, descendant of the Russian ambassador earlier in the century, who had also been part of Dashkova's set and had generally sort of done the rounds in England. Oh, and another little detail, by the way, they visited Hull, from where much appreciated beer was shipped to Russia as ballast. That's interesting. Anyway, what he sort of wrote about, basically what had impressed him: the English have everything to make them happy and enviable. They are not subjected to the arbitrary will and caprices of one person. They only obey what the law demands. Their possessions cannot be touched. They do not fear either the wrath of the sovereign or the hate of ministers or courtesans. They only have to live each according to his pleasure or fantasy. Well, I'm not quite sure about the latter bit. I suspect that if you are a poor English person at that time, you're not quite so liberated to just simply follow your fantasy. Live your best life. But on the other hand, again, what's really striking is even someone who is at the top of the Russian system nonetheless is both aware of its arbitrary, capricious and autocratic nature and actually is envious of those who are not. So again, there is this sense that in some ways Britain is the never-never land that Russia could be. There's also a very strong professional dimension, shall we say, to Russian Anglophilia. And this is something that really struck me in my various travels around Russia and talking to different people, is that people will often have a very positive sense of Britain in general in Russia. But also people will often have a very specific sense of Britain's virtues relating to their own particular professional sphere. You know, you talk to soldiers and they have a very high opinion of the British Armed Forces, particularly its capacity to essentially to move fast and be places, light infantry and so forth, and clearly the Royal Navy. You talk to academics, and I have to say that at the moment, British higher education is not in a very happy place. But nonetheless, Russians, again, have a very, very high regard of not just the scholarly virtues of British academe, which I think are still very much in place, but also a sense that British academics are free to follow the lines of inquiry that matter to them and actually not have to worry too much about whether or not it fits orthodoxy of the time. What they don't fully understand is the amount of time that British academics would end up having to spend doing pointless forms and the like. But so generally speaking, oh, and actually I also mentioned police. Many Russian police basically still have this notion that their British counterparts are somewhere between Sherlock Holmes, the great detective, and Dixon of Dock Green, who was a sort of figure in a, I think it was 1970s, 1980s, British TV series, who was your sort of classic, decent, level-headed Bobby on the beat. You know, so again, I mean, maybe it may well be true, but nonetheless, again, it's this thing that people tend to assume that their particular field, the Brits excel at, which is always quite striking. And yet, at the same time, there is also this notion of Britain as being Russia's most subtle and dangerous antagonist, generally behind every single woe that we find. And this is definitely something that you hear coming from Putin and Patrushev and the like. I remember, I think I've mentioned this in a previous podcast, but if I can't remember what I say in a previous podcast, why should I expect you to? But I remember once sitting down to eat with a Russian think tanker close to the presidential administration and, you know, a certain way along the barking mad nationalist spectrum, but not right at the end. Anyway, who was going on in detail about how the Americans basically run Ukraine and how the Revolution of Dignity was a CIA-managed operation. And then he paused and said, but I'm sure the Brits had the idea in the first place. And he was, I think, being genuine. In that, again, there was a sense that the Americans have all the resources. The Brits have the low-down cunning. And this is one reason why there was infamously one particular toxic TV commentator called the Brits the main bastards, something that on certain quarters has been taken up as a great mark of pride. Now, look, one can draw some interesting and sort of cheap parallels between Russia and Britain historically. They're both imperial powers for a start. I mean, one a land empire and one an essentially maritime one. And as a result, they do, I think, and I'll come on to this more at the end, do have, I think, a much more global concept of themselves and an understanding of the world than many others. There is that sense of, I don't want to say sphere of influence or interest, but something bigger than just themselves. On the one hand, you have the Anglosphere, you know, the various English-speaking nations in part rolled into the Commonwealth of former imperial countries and so forth. And then you've also got the Ruski Mir, the Russian world, that sense of, you know, the Russian speakers everywhere are somehow part of one cinematic universe in which Moscow is the star. And indeed, also a sense of some kind of implicit spiritual significance. You know, Moscow's the third Rome, the true haven of the true form of orthodoxy. Britain, New Jerusalem, cradle of Protestantism and such like. So there are certain similarities, but I'm sure I could probably come up with a similar list for Russia and all sorts of other countries. There's also actually a very strong, I think surprisingly strong for many, tradition of connections between these two countries. I mean, the British Muscovy, or the English rather, Muscovy Company, trading company, was established in 1551. It's even earlier than the East India Company of greater fame. And its base, the Old English Court, is now one of the oldest surviving buildings in Moscow. It's a very odd sight, a 16th century Tudor mansion on Varvarka, literally in the shadow of the Kremlin. And really from that point, one can actually see quite a dense webwork of different connectivities, whether it's on the state monarch level or whether it's on, you know, business and others. You know, in 1570, after all, Ivan the Terrible actually infamously proposed marriage to the Virgin Queen, Elizabeth I. Not, I suspect, because he was carried away by the romantic notions, but precisely because he was firstly looking for an ally and secondly looking for a bolt hole. I mean, an ally, again, you have this fundamental point emerging. Russia is essentially a land nation, and it has a land army as its greatest strength. Britain, of course, an island, its navy has always been its greatest military strength. So there is that sense of complementarity, and, you know, how powerful could they be if these two different sorts of power could be brought together? But more to the point, Ivan the Terrible, increasingly paranoid, was looking for a potential bolt hole, somewhere where, if need be, he could flee and flee in security and comfort. Well, that didn't really work out, you know. But nonetheless, you've got the sight of the increasing flow of British, English, and then in due course, particularly Scottish, specialists going to Russia. People who have the particular technical skills that Russia needs. I mean, for example, in the invasion of the Khanate of Kazan, in the actual siege of Kazan itself, you know, one of the key roles played in the siege works is actually an English engineer by the name of Butler, who comes, you know, with a certain expertise in mining, in other words, digging tunnels underneath walls to bring them down, and generally sort of all kind of siege and counter-siege work. So, you know, already from that point, we have that sense that Britain, which after all, you know, is at the sort of technological edge, is a source to which Russia will look for its expertise. And it's interesting the degree to which clearly there was an awareness of Russia. I mean, take a look at Shakespeare. Shakespeare has within it you know, a whole series of references to Russia. Now, okay, Shakespeare himself, I mean, on the one hand, he's very influential also within Russian culture at different times, though it's worth noting that Hamlet, his, I think, rather tedious play, anyway, but Hamlet in particular proved sufficiently sensitive that both Catherine the Great and Joseph Stalin actually ended up banning it. But nonetheless, you know, Russian novelists and playwrights essentially looked to create explicitly Shakespearean parallels all around them. So, you know, there's obviously the famous Lady Macbeth of Mtsensk and such like. But nonetheless, you know, more broadly, what you actually have from Shakespeare is this understanding. You know, clearly the audience is meant to know something about the kind of clichés, caricatures and tropes of Russians. So in Shakespeare's The Winter's Tale, you have the Queen of Sicily, Hermione, falsely accused of infidelity, says, "The Emperor of Russia was my father. Oh, that he were alive and here beholding his daughter's trial, that he did but see the flatness of my misery, yet with eyes of pity, not revenge." So already you've got the sense, not only that there is a place called Russia, and that it has an emperor, but also that somehow it is a powerful force somewhere. Later on, in, you know, again, the classic Russian bear crops up in Henry V. Duke of Orleans says, "Foolish curs that run winking into the mouth of a Russian bear and have their heads crushed like rotten apples." So already we got the sense, Russia, the bear, going all the way back to Shakespeare. And there's other examples in Love, Labour's Lost and such like. I'm not going to run through them. But again, it's interesting, the idea that Russia and Muscovy are being mentioned in ways that clearly Shakespeare expects the audience to understand and respond to. Anyway, onward. Peter the Great. Peter the Great, let's face it, an intensely practical man who was also obsessed with the idea of building a navy, hence his grand embassy, in which he travelled to Europe, but particularly going to the Netherlands and Britain, the great naval powers of the age. It's one of the reasons why, you know, if one looks at a lot of Russian words relating to ships sailing and navies, many of them have their roots in English or even more so in Dutch. So he goes there, he hires shipwrights, he tries to learn the various skills. And not surprising, I mean, one of his tutors had been a Scottish mercenary, Patrick Gordon. It's worth noting that, on the other hand, he was there for skills, not for, shall we say, political lessons. He goes and sees Parliament. He's told about the various ways in which a British monarch is to a degree constrained by constitutional niceties, and immediately decides that English freedom is not appropriate for Russians. Moving on, though, again, as different needs arose, then different types of specialists were brought in and different types of skills contacted. In the time of Catherine the Great, for example, one of the great legal scholars of her age, Simeon Desnitsky, well, he had actually studied with Adam Smith at the University of Glasgow. Whereas when it comes to industry, one can look at the example of, and I'm just picking individual examples here, Brigadier General Sir Samuel Bentham, brother of the rather more famous Jeremy. He spends 10 years in Russia, largely working for Potemkin, Catherine the Great's favourite. Initially, he's hired as a shipbuilder, then he becomes more of a sort of general engineer and inventor. And incidentally, it's in Russia that he comes up with the idea of the building called the Panopticon, a circular one with a sort of central shaft in which there are overseers, that his brother Jeremy would later popularise as a notion for a prison. Samuel was not thinking of it as a prison, I think it's fair to say. But anyway, that doesn't really matter. So on it goes. 19th century. There's all kinds of connections, again, because of investment and trade. But not just that, actually. I mean, it's also worth noting that we have a different kind of London grad emerging there, in which Britain also provides a haven for revolutionaries and such like, including Lenin. The revolutionary newspaper Kolokol, for a while, is based in London and so forth. But as I said, mainly it's about capital. So, you know, what can one look at? Well, take Donetsk. You know, it's now one of the cradles of conflict in eastern Ukraine. Well, until 1961, the city of Donetsk was actually called Yusovka. Why? Well, because essentially it was established after John Hughes Sofka, anyway, a Welshman with experience in shipbuilding and armaments, won a concession from the government to set up a metallurgy factory there. And really, that's at the same time, you know, essentially the whole Donbass industry really begins to emerge, the coal mining and such like. Indeed, back in 2014, there was this joke that was circulating on social media in the Donbass, declaring that we are demanding a referendum on returning Yuzovka to its original bosom, Great Britain. Just think what might have happened. Anyway, it was not just about industry and so forth. I mean, even if one looks, for example, at the ridiculously high-end department store in Moscow, Tsum. Well, originally, that was Muir and Mirilis, founded in 1857 by two, again, Scottish businessmen. So, you know, basically speaking, it is clear that actually Britain plays more of a role than we may sometimes accept. You know, it's very much, it's a strong trading partner and increasingly a strong political partner or antagonist, which helps explain maybe why in November 1917, at a time when Britain is absolutely trying to conspire against the Bolshevik regime, Lenin says, England is our greatest enemy. So, let's take a break and then take a look at, conversely, England in the Russian mind and Russia in the English. Just the usual mid-episode reminder that you're listening to the In Moscow Shadows podcast. Its corporate partner and sponsor is Conductor, which provides software for crisis exercises in hybrid warfare, counter-terrorism, civil affairs and the like. But you can also support the podcast yourself by going to patreon.com/inmoscowshadows. And remember that patrons get a variety of additional perks depending on their tier, as well as knowing that they're supporting this peerless source on all things Russian. And you can also follow me on Twitter at Mark Galliotti, or on Facebook, Mark Galliotti on Russia. Now, back to the episode. So let me expand on that earlier snapshot I gave about how Russians view the English. And the sense that there's always a desire to try and kind of connect with them. I mean, I love the fact, for example, that there was this Slavophile, Alexei Chomyakov, whose view was that the very term English or Anglian was just a nasal form of the Slavonic term Uglichi, who were meant to be a lost tribe of Eastern Slavs. And that therefore, actually, what it was that the English were really just sort of, again, distant cousins of the Russians, but distant cousins who had conserved the essence of Russian native justice. So there is this attempt to basically roll all of Britain into Ruski Mir. That is, I have to say, a rather extreme example, which sadly never took root. But nonetheless, I mean, it is clear that there is a very sort of strong sense of respect for Britain and its culture, which isn't just its political culture, but also style. I mean, the very fact that the word gentlemen sort of made it into Russian after a fashion, literature and the like. And beyond that, I mean, I'm delighted that, for example, Stoke-on-Trent has left its mark on Russia in that its potteries, you know, Spode, Wedgwood and the like, became popular in Russia from Catherine the Great's reign onwards and became very much the kind of the benchmark by which other kinds of pottery and the like were assessed. And that speaks to, I think, as the second element of the Russian appreciation of the English, which is actually in their competence. Now, competence is, of course, a two-edged sword in that it's competence as a partner and as an ally and so forth, but also competence as an enemy. So there is always this sense that we are a respected foe. This is the irony. I mean, Brits often regard themselves or sort of flagellate themselves as being an easy target for the Russians, whether it's in terms of the Skripal case, whether it's in terms of the influx of Russian money in the London gradness. However, I think to a large degree this says more, frankly, about contemporary British insecurities and a tendency to regard themselves rather more poorly than many, because I certainly don't get the sense that from the Russian perspective that is the case. But anyway, this very sense of Britain as an enemy, but as a dangerous one, and as a subtle one, again, subtleties, there's all kinds of various attributes that can be applied to the Americans. And again, there is a kind of Americanophilia, if that's a word, also to be found amongst the Russians. But that's a very different kind of appreciation. Subtlety does not come into that. And that helps explain why we crop up so much on toxic television broadcasts and the like, how much they seek to vilify Britain and tear it down. I remember there was this glorious point when the always over-the-top and deeply unpleasant TV pundit Olga Skabayeva suggested that such was the cost-of-living crisis in Britain that squirrels had replaced other forms of meat in British restaurants. You know, actually, frankly, I wouldn't have a problem if that was the case. But no, that is not, I can honestly say, what is actually happening in the UK. But again, there is this point of actually trying to tell Russians that no, don't regard the Brits as doing okay. No, this is why they're in such a terrible state. And in some ways, I've heard people say that there's an interesting parallel with how the Iranians also see Britain. But anyway, what's interesting is this does not seem to have manifested itself or led to, at the moment at least, a deep and serious swing away from like and respect for the British amongst Russians. It's now about a year old, but nonetheless, a survey, and look, we have to treat with great caution any kind of opinion polls and surveys carried out in a police state like Russia. But nonetheless, you know, a survey that actually found that a majority of Russians agreed with the statement that Britain was an enemy of the Russian Federation. And yet separately, also a majority said that, in fact, they regarded Britain positively, which is quite an interesting thing. So actually you have people who regard Britain as both an enemy and positive. On a more human level, James Pearce in BNE Intellinews' Moscow blog reported that British teachers and au pairs are in more demand now, particularly for the language. Au pairs can make up to $5,000 a month. Well, that's a lot of money in Russia. Working for Russia's richest families. Tutors still collect decent money from private lessons. One Briton in West Moscow is having to turn students down. Those working at schools are being treated better. We're not easily replaceable anymore, one tells me. They piss me off. Other schools are all looking. Now, obviously, you know, learning English language is not something that is disappearing. You have a small increase, for example, in the number of Russians that are learning Chinese. But again, if I can quote a Russian academic, he said that basically they're learning Chinese simply because they think that might be practical from a career point of view, not because they actually want to. They learn English because they want to learn English. So there is this interesting way in which Britain still looms in the Russian mind. Now, that's different from how Russia is perceived in the English mind. Certainly, it's distinctly less positive. And frankly, it can often be deeply patronising, especially as it was in the case of the sort of height of the London grad money bonanza. Now, it didn't help that much of the Russian money that was coming over was definitely that trashy new money. But still, the point is that actually you have a rather negative perspective, but the interesting thing is the degree to which Russia is, shall we say, well on the cultural radar. Before the invasion, for example, the full-scale invasion, in 2020, there was a poll by YouGov which found 46% of Brits having a negative perspective and 17% positive. But the interesting thing is that 100% of the sample said that they felt that they knew enough about Russia to be able to make some kind of a meaningful response. In a September 2021 poll, so in other words, still before the full-scale invasion, 34% of Britons considered Russia a hostile threat. And unsurprisingly, following the invasion, then that almost doubled to 64%. At that time, the most positive people towards Russia were 18 to 24-year-olds. Now, one might say, oh, well, of course they're young. What do these young whippersnappers know? But the point is they're also very heavily exposed to kind of the trends of the time. And what's clear is the degree to which that is still the case. Even so, at present, again, entirely unsurprisingly, attitudes are very definitely negative towards Russia. In a Pew survey in 2023, for example, only 10% of British respondents said that they were favourable to Russia, which is The same, for example, is in Germany. And it's worth noting, I mean, the highest European sample that they presented was in Greece, I suppose, yes, an Orthodox country. 32% still favourable towards Russia despite the Ukraine war. So, negative perspectives. But, again, what kind of negative perspective? The striking thing is that even as villains, there is a certain sense of competence. I mean, despite tabloid accounts of the kind of Russian incompetence in Ukraine, or indeed the surreal cover-up for the Skripal case, with the suggestion that these two guys had just gone to go and see the spire of Salisbury Cathedral, nonetheless, there is that sense of Russians as a nation still punching above their weight. There was an interesting experiment, again, sort of survey using focus groups, which was building up a word cloud of the words and phrases that people you would use in association to with various countries. But with Russia, it was the ones that it was that they were dangerous, that they were smart, that they were thinkers. Now, okay, I mean, maybe it's the whole chess grandmaster cliche rearing its ugly head, but that doesn't matter. I mean, the same way as, frankly, Brits do not stumble around in the fog wearing bowler hats, as you'd sometimes think that some Russians might assume, so too. What's interesting is that the perspective of Russians is, on the whole, appears to be not that they are fur hat wearing primitives squatting in wooden huts, but precisely that they are suave antagonists. This is more James Bond villain than anything else. And I'd also add that it's worth noting that even while Britain is much less positive about Russians as a country, rather, but on the other hand also regards them as being sophisticated and dangerous as individuals, it's also worth noting that we are interested in them disproportionately. Again, another survey example. Are you interested in Russia? This was something that was done about across university students in Europe. Again, I think it was 2021. It was certainly before the full-scale invasion. Britain came out amongst the highest. And what's interesting is, I would say, and maybe this sounds immodest and self-serving, but I think it also reflects the fact that, and feeds into the fact, that Britain still has a disproportionate academic strength in looking at Russia, whether we're talking language and literature or whether we're talking politics, society and history. So again, what's striking to me is that there is this sense that Russia is a powerhouse. Take, for example, the way opinions shifted so dramatically in World War II. Now, of course, when you're in an existential struggle for survival, you are generally going to be thinking positive thoughts about anyone who is on your side. Before World War II, certainly British official perceptions of Russia were deeply critical. And I'm not talking about, you know, in a moral or other perspective, but there was this sense that basically Russia was a paper tiger. Chamberlain in particular, I mean, he described as pathetic those who felt that, in fact, Britain's future might in any way be benefit from an alliance with Britain. He said that in the House of Commons, as I recall. And generally, there was this view, looking at how the Red Army had performed in the Winter War with Finland, in the battles of Khalkhin-Gol with the Japanese over in Mongolia, and indeed their military advisors and their technologies in the Spanish Civil War. You know, there basically was an assumption that Stalin's purges of the high command, which had indeed gutted many of the best officers out of it, but nonetheless that backwardness and just a general sense that the Bolsheviks couldn't organise their way out of a paper bag meant that actually the Soviet Union was a relatively large but negligible political force. Didn't quite work out that way. And instead, there was a sort of huge public propaganda campaign, frankly, to sort of stress that, you know, John Bull and Johnny Ivan were now hand in hand and lockstep pushing back the nasty Nazis. But this was not just simply something that came from above just to try and sort of reassure a worried population. This is also something that emerged quite strongly. You know, there was increasing concern about the fact that Uncle Joe was almost becoming something of a cult figure, particularly within British forces. For some reason, it was especially evident in the forces that were in the North African area of operations. You know, and just generally, there was a strongly sort of positive feeling about Russia that shifted very, very quickly. So this is the interesting thing. We can see actually that the nature of the relationship can pivot quite rapidly depending on the circumstances. But in every case, there clearly is a sense that there is a relationship. And this is one of the reasons why I think in the distant future, obviously we're not talking about anything that is feasible now, you know, under Putin or anything like that, a sense that in fact, once again, Britain and Russia can find that it actually has quite a lot of things in common and reasons to work in concert in the future. I mean, first of all, these are two countries which are both, shall we say, of Europe but not in Europe. They are the bookends of Europe. They regard themselves as European countries, but they certainly do not consider themselves to be subsumed within the wider continental Gestalt. Indeed, both countries have historically, and I would suggest still today, political interests in actually undermining any attempts to create a single, powerful, coherent European unit. And I think this is something that in due course, and again, I'm looking well over the current political horizon, but I think in due course will provide basis for some kind of pragmatic political cooperation. But also, as I said, that there is this interesting outlook that is, I would say, much broader than, for example, most European countries, with the possible exception of France, for obvious imperial reasons. You know, there was this big hype on global Britain. To a large extent, it was a cheap slogan just to try and create some sense of some kind of geopolitical vision. But the point is, the very fact that it could be deployed says something, again, that Britain is still a global operator or seeks to think in those terms. It may often not have the resources to do so, but it certainly has the outlook. And likewise, Russia is indeed a global country. One of the interesting things is that there's a whole sort of body of literature now emerging, showing that, you know, even in the 18th as well as the 19th century, Russia actually was a significant import-export power, which was trading all around the world. And with that trade went cultural connections, embassies, and the like. You know, like it or not, although the Russian Empire was essentially a coterminous, contiguous land empire, nonetheless, the imperial mindset meant that it did, I think, have a global perspective that many other countries lack. And there is more than a little bit of commonality of interest there. So to sum up, I think there is a reason more than the political opportunism of Boris Johnson why Britain was, from the beginning, very much at the forefront of pushing the support for Ukraine against Russia and regarding this as part of a much kind of wider political struggle, just as there is a reason why Britain is the main bastard of Russian ultranationalist pundits. We do loom in each other's geopolitical imaginations more than either of us might like to admit. And that means that, again, someday in the future, it'll be interesting to see what can happen if we can pivot back away from the current antagonistic relationship, which is clearly driven largely by, or almost entirely, by Putin's neo-imperialistic designs in Ukraine and elsewhere. Once again, find some way of reconnecting in that positive way that, well, dates back to the 16th century. Fancy that. But finally, I would add that I do think that there is a more immediate practical political dimension to this, in that Britain should appreciate, and okay, I'm now clambering back onto my soapbox, so forgive me. Britain should appreciate the degree of cultural traction it still has within Russia. And this is why I absolutely believe that, you know, while we continue to do our bit for Ukraine and the like, we should also be seeing how we can mobilise that cultural traction in a way to reach out to ordinary Russians, to make sure that we build the kind of relationship, if as far as is possible, and it's not that possible, but nonetheless, insofar as we can, with the Russian population, so that when Putin goes, and Putin will go, we are in a position to be able to actually say, we have always been your friends. We have been the enemies, not of Russia, but of a particular regime, and we have been opposed not to Russian interests, but to that particular regime's policies of neo-imperialist war and the like. So we need to reach out much more to ordinary Russians. And yes, that may well be through the internet and through the media and through even such new opportunities as video games and the like. But one way or the other, we should not be wasting the Anglophile dimension of Russian culture simply because we are peeved by the Anglophobia as well. Okay, time to climb off the soapbox. Thank you very much indeed. Well, that's the end of another episode of the In Moscow Shadow podcast. Just as a reminder, beyond this, you can follow my blog, also called In Moscow Shadows. Follow me on Twitter, at Mark Galeotti, or Facebook, Mark Galeotti on Russia. This podcast is made possible by generous and enlightened patrons, and you too can be one. Just go along to my Patreon page, that's patreon.com/InMoscowShadows, and decide which tier you want to join, getting access to exclusive materials and other perks. However, whether or not you contribute, thank you very much indeed for listening. Until next time, keep well.